It's Ted Smith, Real One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Smith?
Yes, I was born in Aldershot, the home of the British Army, into an army family on July the 25th, 1933. I was born... my father at that time was a sergeant in the Duke of Wellington's regiment, and my mother was a girl from Gosport. My father joined the army because he was left as an orphan at the age of 14, and he felt, he was a Halifax lad, and he felt that the best option for his future and a guarantee of a roof over his head and four square meals was to go into the services. It was the only thing for him, and it was the only thing for him for the rest of his life. He met my mother when the regiment was based in Gosport in Hampshire. When I was born, there were three other brothers before me. Les, who was about eight, Sid, who was about seven, Don, who was about two. Another brother was to follow in 1940 to make five, a family of five. We didn't have any girls. Whether that was good, bad or indifferent, I don't know. We lived in married quarters in the barracks. And my mother had her hands quite full with four sons, eight, seven and two, and now a baby. However, she was going to find that life was exceptionally hard when 6 weeks later, 6 weeks after I was born, the regiment were dispatched to the northwest frontier of India. Now, of course, that's northwest frontier of Pakistan. The problem for Mum was, of course, having four lads travelling all that way, quite a long way away, away from all their relations. There's not a lot recorded about the journey on the ship, but I understand that it took about 3 weeks. I've always found the stories to be very, very intriguing, and the regret in my life is that I never recorded them as they were being told, and I've had to call back on my memory as best I possibly could and use my brother, my eldest brother, who's now still alive, to put different details in. There's no record, as far as I can see, or as far as I found, of what ports of call the ship called out, and everything on the ship was quite sketchy. But I found that it was a troop carrier, not designed with comfort in mind, and certainly was not anything like the QE2. There must have been, at my calculation, something like 1,500 to 2,000 people aboard. And I take this from records that show that the battalion, which was the 2nd battalion of the Duke of Wellington's, was in number something like 750 troops. And other pointers have always indicated they would have the equal amount of families aboard. So you're talking 1,500 to 2,000 people. So it must have been very, very crowded. The regulations in those days were strange, as some people would think, in that the soldiers were not allowed to mix with the families. And so we had, so I'm told that is, we had the families at one end and the troops at the other end. And they slept and lived apart. This meant, of course, Mum had very little help from Dad. And she had four children and this little brat that had just come along, myself. So I can tell that the journey took about 3 weeks. And finally docked at Bombay. From there, the regiment then went on to Camp T near Nagpur. But how long they actually stay there is not recorded, as far as I can see. And there's no record of what conditions they were housed in or anything like that. But it was a stopping over sort of situation. And then they embarked on a very long journey of about 1,500 miles to Nowshera.
Have you heard anything about the train journey? Because that can be quite dramatic
Yeah. Now going on to a 1,500-mile journey to Nowshera. Nowshera being about 12 miles from Peshawar in the northwest frontier. And that, of course, is where today we've got all the troubles with Bin Laden and the Taliban. The pictures that you see nowadays about Nowshera and that area are frightening. But when you think about what it must have been 68 years ago, it's terrifying. And those are the conditions we're going into. The journey is recorded in something I read as having taken 4 days. But Les, my eldest brother, who was about 8 at that time, is adamant that it took considerably longer. It wasn't a luxury class, and of course, again, there'll be very crowded conditions. And again, the regulations were that the soldiers were at one end and the families were at the other. And during the, the periods when the train was on the move, everybody was confined to the carriages. And you can imagine the crowded conditions and the heat and the children suffering from the prolonged confinement, the inevitable smell and the bugs and the bees and and the fleas must have been terrible for anybody. One of the things that I've been told is the frequent stops for bodily needs, which is a nice way of putting it, when everybody made for the bushes and so forth. Feeding, of course, was important. But apparently at every stop, the physical training instructors got the whole complement of troops and families out, and they went through the physical jerks to combat the confines of the travelling conditions. At night, when they stopped, a full armed guard was put round the whole contingent to safeguard against the anti-British tribesmen. How they slept is not quite clear, but I imagine it would be a mixture of carriages, tents, open air, that sort of thing. But it wouldn't have been comfortable by any means. I've tried to get a picture for myself of the conditions that this would have been, and for that I've always thought of a film which the title escapes me, but it was Kenneth Moore and Lauren Bacall up in that area on a train rescuing an Indian prince. I don't know what the name, can't remember the name. And then what I do, I flavour it with a bit of a film that was on television of a train journey taken by Mark Tully, the BBC correspondent, which finishes at the Khyber Pass, only a few miles from Peshawar. And then for a bit of a laugh, of course, I add a bit of the Up the Khyber from the Carry On films. and that gives me an overall good picture of what the area was like. In the records that I have seen, that it appears that the train arrived at Nowshera on the 25th of March 1934, which would mean that the whole trip from Southampton, where the ship sailed from, to Camp and through Camp T, was in total 5.5 months, which in anybody's language must have been a hell of a journey, particularly for Mum, the families, the kids, and the cramped conditions. And if she'd not been such a strong woman, she would have caved in, as indeed all the others would. But there was something round the corner that Mum and nobody else knew that would have floored most people. And that was that Mum noticed that I wasn't quite moving as I should have been doing at that early age. And she'd had 3 strapping lads before, and so she felt that it was right that she should get some medical advice. The only medical advice she could have got was from the medical officer of the battalion. There were no hospitals or anything that around that area. And from what she told me, he turned to her and said that he thought I'd contracted infantile paralysis, as it was known then. He then went on to say that if he, that means me, if he lives, he will be severely crippled. But according to what my mother told me, she had other ideas. I could imagine the shock that my mother had hearing that news, because infantile prowess was rife and still is rife in India and that area. And you can imagine that from pictures that we see now, frequently see now, that she would have seen in the village and so forth, all the infantile prowess's victims who had been really not treated at all would be going around the streets. They'd see the people with distorted limbs and people walking on the knees and just being left to fend for themselves by begging. And as I say, the pictures that we've seen show that that is still the case today. And I'm certain Mum would have said to herself, well, that's not for my son. From all reports, she massaged my legs and spine 2 or 3 times a day, and she did everything she possibly could think, and everything that was suggested to her would help, and, of course, more. This was going to prove, of course, the ideal treatment, and no one could have had any better treatment. At the same time, of course, she had to look after the other kids, and she had to endure the hardships of now Shearer in the Northwest Frontier. In those days, of course, there wasn't such a thing as there would be today, and that is repatriation. Today you'd been flown straight home together with the family and put straight into hospital. There was no such thing as that in those days. Apart from this whole problem of my illness, now Shearer was not the best place in the world, and a lot of dangers lurking around, and strong possibility, of course, that people will get other disease and particularly infantile prowess, and that must have been a fear that was constantly in her mind. Mum, of course, much later was to get malaria herself, and this added to her problems, which stayed with her for a very long time. Apparently there was support from other families, because it was quite a community relationship with all the rest of the garrison, and I heard of other mothers coming in and helping and what have you. We also had the local bearers, as they were called. This is the natives, and I hate to use the word natives too much nowadays, but the natives who worked for us in the houses and looked after the family as much as they possibly could. And apparently they were very, very devoted people and would do absolutely anything for us and my brothers and myself. But apart from that, there was a hostile section around in Now Shearer, and, of course, all around that time. And every caution had to be taken to safeguard yourself against the people who would want to harm the British. Les, my eldest brother, and Sid, who were attending school, had to start very early in the morning and finish by lunchtime to avoid the hottest part of the day, and then the afternoons for themselves. They were escorted to school and back by armed soldiers because of the risk from the tribesmen. And not many kids today, apart from in Ireland, I suppose, if you want to put that in, would get that treatment. The family itself, and very important that these things come, the family itself own very little of its own. And one of the lasting memories that I've got is that everything had a broad arrow on it. The blankets, the sheets, the furniture, it all belonged to the government and nothing belonged to us. And it sticks in my mind, and every time I see a broad arrow, though you don't see them much nowadays, I think of those days. And the reason for this is the nomadic life that we lived.
Could you talk a bit of, do you remember much about, I mean, as you, you know, got older, do you remember much about the married quarters, you know, that you were living in there?
No, I can only assume they were typical sort of wooden-type barracks. I don't think in those areas there would be much more than wooden-type or mud-type barracks, and I think it must have been in a compound of some kind. It would have been guarded, I think, by troops all day and 24 hours a day. And everything that went off in those confines. But it would be nice to see if there are photographic evidence of this sort of thing, and you could get a clearer picture. I have seen one or two little bits of things, but not enough to get a clear picture of what the kind of thing we lived in. And nobody really remembers the barracks. It's just the place you went home to eat and sleep and what have you. You know, nowadays, of course, everybody would be on about the paint and so forth. The one thing that I kept for some years, which I wish I kept still, and that was a very, very strong wooden box built of 1¼-inch timber. And it was built, obviously, to withstand rough treatment. And printed on the side of it was, "Not wanted on voyage." And what I was told, what Mum told me and Dad told me, that this box was like some other boxes that they had, and everything that they didn't want was on the ship itself, was on the voyage, was put in these very strong boxes and stowed away below decks. And over the years, I used this box myself and kept it until only a few years ago. And I stored things in it and kept tools in it and so forth. Then I offered it to my son-in-law, who said, "No way, did he want that?" And so I decided to chop it up, and it was only then, excuse me, it was only then that I realised how strong it had been built, and you don't get them built like that these days. Mum, of course, was a very good cook, as she had to be with the family. And we recall, Les and I and Don and whatever, we recall the very wholesome but very plain food that she could deal up then. And in those remote conditions, of course, there must have been a problem for getting hold of the provisions for the meal, and, of course, the fuel for cooking it and so forth. And it conjures up quite a major problem. But I always assume that, of course, like everything else, that this sort of thing was provided by the battalion. But I can't ever see broad arrows on loaves of bread and things like that. One of the lasting memories is the introduction to curry, which in those days in England was hardly known. But this became, and still is, the firm favourite of our family. And when we eventually returned to Blighty, as they said in those days, of course we say UK, to Blighty, of course, we were seen as very peculiar people eating this funny food that they ate abroad. And, of course, nowadays, curry is one of the favourites in the UK. The storage of food, it makes you wonder how they kept food in any decent condition, because there were no refrigerators or anything like that up there. And I doubt whether there's enough electricity to feed them if there was. But later on, when we finished up in Malta, I can recall vividly very, very large blocks of ice being delivered daily. And these were then put into the pantry or a cold room, and everything that had to be kept was kept near that. Again, I would love to see pictures of that sort of thing. Any footage of that sort of thing would be grand. The records I read about the troops and their skirmishes with the tribesmen say that the conditions were extremely hot. And they mention in one report 37 degrees centigrade. And together with the muskos and the flies and the snakes and all the unseen other enemies of nature, it would have been only unbearable, terribly unbearable, and only the fittest of people would be able to fight in those conditions. But the families would have shared exactly the same conditions of discomfort and that the fathers had to endure. But the amazing point, and I find an amazing point, is that in all the descriptions that I've read about the troops going up into the hills, it tells you in minute detail of how they were kitted out with the shorts they wore, the boots they wore, the putties they wore, the types of vests and so forth that they wore, and virtually telling you what scars they had on their bums and things like that. But there's not a word in all these things, and not a mention at all, about the families who were not that far away, enduring, not fighting, of course, although amongst themselves, probably not, but enduring the same conditions. And yet the historians have forgotten this, have left it out. One of the things I remember, and of course being a dog lover, is that we were apparently given a dog when we got there. And no one can remember its name, but I do remember Mum telling me that it was an Airedale. And of course, being a Yorkshire regiment, it would have to be an Airedale. And the reasons that we had this dog given, from what I was told, was that a family who were going back to England could not take him back with them because of quarantine problems. And so he was handed on to us. This is quite common with dogs and cats and other animals, I suppose, who were passed down for this reason. I don't know what we did at the end of our time there, but I assume that if the dog was still alive, he would too would have been passed on. There's no hospital near, and I assume the nearest hospital would be somewhere like Peshawar, 12 miles away. But Les tells the tale over and over again, that's Les, my eldest brother, of being in hospital when the old Quetta earthquake took place. And he was thrown out of his bed. And of course the thing that we tease him about nowadays is that every time there's an earthquake anywhere in the world, we get this tale about Les being thrown out by the Quetta earthquake. And of course there was an earthquake fairly recently up there, and I think we had a double dose. There are no shops to visit up there, of course, and I don't suppose we had enough money to buy anything. But one of the advantages of being in an army family, or in a family like us, where there were four boys, and something that helped the economics of the family was the traditional hand-me-down of clothes and other things. And this was the situation till I ran out of older brothers. Or they went off to the war and, you know, that sort of thing. And I started to see what a new suit looked like and new trousers. But I suppose in those days I wasn't wearing their hand-me-downs because I would be in nappies and that sort of things. Probably things that Mum had kept from earlier times, from when the others were babies. When the troops weren't out fighting, of course, together with the families, they had to make their own amusements, and there were many competitions between various sections of the battalion, between wives, fathers, children. And these were in the main rugby, football, hockey, tennis. But both my mother and my father were good on the rifle range, and from all reports were battalion champions. In any concert that they may have organised, my mother would have been an automatic choice to contribute, because she would have to have a go at anything. But she also could play the piano, and she had the most beautiful voice. And her rendering of Gounod's Ave Maria, that was something that really had to be heard. My brothers and myself became good shots, and that's...
Do you remember what sort of game? I mean, you were very, very young, and a lot of people don't remember anything before they're four or five.
No.
Do you remember playing what you sort of in the compound?
Or? No, I mean, I can't remember it. I know that that's the sort of thing that they would have done. And of course, in the records that I've read about the regiments, there's quite a lot written about the inter-regimental tournaments and so forth. That so, rugby being a natural thing, football and that sort of thing, and tennis. All that sort of thing would be the kind of thing that they would have got up to. Plus, of course, a few card games and that sort of thing. But I think they had to entertain themselves with anything that they could dream up. Now, Shearer.
Now, what about what state were you in? I mean, how I'm not quite sure what happened with polio. How long were you ill with it for, and how long was your mother treating you for?
It was an early-ish, early days, really, for polio. It was only discovered in 1916, so it was fairly early in the history of polio itself. And there wasn't really much to do other than just wait for it to go away.
And how long would that take?
Well, I was yet to go into hospital when we got back to the UK. I had no hospital treatment. And as I say, there was no repatriation.
But it lasted a long time, wasn't it?
Well, it lasted quite a long time. And I actually came out of hospital.
sorry, I don't want to run you ahead. No. So you had it all the time you were in India?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, because it never leaves you. I've still got it now. I've still got it today, polio and the late effects of polio. So it doesn't leave you. It's just that the virus, when it strikes you, attacks the nervous system. I don't want to go too deeply into it because it attacks the nervous system. And you've got to wait until it's done its damage. And then the body starts to rebuild itself, and you are deemed then to have got over polio, and you're left then with the residue of it. And in my case, it was a distorted spine and a crippled right leg. You don't actually get over it, now we know, but that was always assumed that once you got past that point, it was something of the past. And later on, of course, we now know that that hasn't been the case, that later on some things had built up until we now have got what they call post-polio syndrome, the late effects of polio.
So all the time you were in India, your mother was giving you these massages and attending to you.
That's right, yeah. On a daily basis, 3-4 times a day, and other people would, I suppose, come in and help. So, but there's nothing more to do. I suppose she would have been over the moon if there was a hospital that I could have gone into, or if they'd have said, right, we're going to send you home and you can go. He can go into hospital for proper treatment. Those things didn't happen in those days. Families weren't of top priority.
Now, you seem to have stayed up in Nowshera till about 1937.
Yep, yes.
But you're not exactly, you don't know which month or...
Well, there are conflicting records, but there is a record of what the records, unfortunately, are to do with the regiments and the 1st and 2nd battalions of the Duke of Wellington's. It doesn't actually say if the families went on a particular journey or whether they didn't. So you've got to surmise, together with snippets of information, as to whether you came home with a particular battalion and what have you. But it does appear that we were there, as I was always told, about 4 years in India itself. And then we were in Nowshera, which had been established for 1870, I should say. And in one record, there's it says that our battalion, the 2nd battalion, consisted of 785 troops of all ranks. But as I've said, there's no mention of family, but it would be fair to assume there was double that amount, or there was an equal amount of family. So you're talking about, going up for 2,000 people. Interestingly enough, from a military point of view, was that at that time, the battalion was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel M.N. Cox, M.C. And the Nowshera Brigade, which consisted of the 2nd Battalion and 2 Gurkha battalions, was commanded by Brigadier H.R.L.G. Alexander, C.S.I., D.S.O., who was to become Field Marshal Lord Alexander of Tunis in the Second World War, a very distinguished soldier indeed. One of the funny things that I tell people, and my memory my memory helps me on this, is that there must have been a battalion band, because my mother used to go around singing with great gusto the marching tunes that all the bands played then and they played now. And I say singing because the girls, the wives, have made up their own words to go with the tunes. But I wouldn't like to repeat the words that I used to hear, not even in the wildest rugby booze up.